but people are struggling and they're looking at this job and saying, I don't think I can do this for 20 more years. And who gets hurt when that happens? That's our kids, right? It's our kids who have to live in the city and go to school for the next, you know, for 12, 13 years of their lives, who won't have that stability. And a lot of our kids have already experienced that because a lot of our schools have already been underserved and underfunded for years.
This is the Bris Poinsett Show. This is the Bris Poinsett Show. For the world's most dangerous infomercial, I'm your host, Bris Poinsett. Along with my producer, Ada, we bring you this weekly commentary and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio of the Portland Art Museum. This is the best of the Bris Poinsett Show, the world's most dangerous infomercial. I'm your host, Bris Poinsett, and along with my producer, Ada, we bring you this weekly commentary and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio of the Portland Art Museum. You can catch the full show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7. You can also catch clips on youtube.com/Bris Poinsett, plus exclusive bonus content on patreon.com/Bris Poinsett. Make sure to follow us on twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM, that's Numbers with a Z, or the Numbers Podcast Network on thenumberspodcast.com. Again, that's Numbers with a Z, or wherever you get your podcasts. Help support this channel and get early access to videos plus exclusive content and patrons-only live discussions by becoming a member at patreon.com/Bris Poinsett. Welcome to a special edition of the Bris Poinsett Show. The Portland Association of Teachers are on the verge of a strike, and we've got interviews with union members. But first, why might PPS teachers strike for the first time ever? So, according to a recent article from OPB, just give you a quick little summation of some of the reasons the PAT and the district are in impasse. According to this article, during the September 7th mediation session, the PPS bargaining team offered educators a 10% cost of living increase over 3 years. Officials said this increase, along with a previous offer to raise starting salaries, would mean Portland's starting educators would make Portland's starting educators the highest paid teachers in the metro area's 6 largest districts. They also proposed an extra day of teacher-directed planning time. The district had already increased planning time to 360 minutes or 6 hours per week. The Portland Teachers Association is asking for more than twice the cost of living adjustment, a 21.5% increase in the same time frame. They also want a minimum of 420 minutes or 7 hours of planning time per week. Camas School District teachers in Washington last week won a 13% increase in compensation over the next 2 years. Evergreen Public Schools teachers won at least a 17% increase over the next 3 years. Others in the area have similar targets. But Portland District officials said those aren't apples-to-apples comparisons because Washington structures state funding differently and smaller Oregon districts pay lower wages. Still, from the union's perspective, the district's proposed pay increase is not enough to keep up with rising costs, and the added teacher-directed planning day shrinks the overall increase. Recently released data from the National Council on Teacher Quality, a D.C.-based nonprofit, shows Portland is one of the least affordable metro areas in the country for new teachers looking to rent a one-bedroom apartment. So, with that in mind, I attended the Portland Association of Teachers Art Build and spoke with PAT President Angela Bonilla, Vice President Jackie Dixon, and liaison to Zone 4 Joanne Shepherd to discuss where negotiations are, what teachers are asking for, and misconceptions around the teachers' union and their activities. So I want to be transparent here. My thoughts on unions have definitely evolved over the years. Growing up, most of the union talk in my house was about either the police union and whatever horrible thing they were trying to defend and what officer they're trying to get off, usually from assaulting or murdering a Black person. Or when the teachers union would come at my mom, who was a longtime administrator, over a pushback against getting police involved with the kids. You notice a theme with police here. We also talked about the history of racism within unions a lot. So needless to say, my view was not always the most positive when it just came to general labor activity. I've since grown up and gained a much broader engagement and understanding of the role of unions in protecting workers. And I think the trajectory of my thought process really isn't that uncommon. So if you look in media, generally, when there's a strike especially, but unions in general are painted as sort of like this scorn, these greedy, ungrateful workers. But when you have, especially a moment in time like now, where you have the one of the biggest strike waves, if not the biggest strike wave in the U.S. in decades, when the conversation becomes more mainstream and you see the argument between the workers and the CEOs, that same trajectory I had, you start seeing it catching on with other people. And whether it's the Writers and Actors Guild, the auto workers, teachers unions, again, in aforementioned nearby Southwest Washington, people are seeing the power of unions and their necessity. A lot of people see the very CEO wealthy, individual slant of the media coverage of labor action. And even if there are people who themselves are, would be protected or would be served by unions, they just don't, they take the side of, often cases, galling billionaires. And I just, it's hard to wrap your mind around, but you gotta cut through that. So with that in mind, I went to the Art Build. This is an event where teachers and community members could get together, make art in support of the teachers, including banners, parachutes, and screen printing, and also just commune. While I was there, I talked with teachers and supporters, many from other unions, dabbled in a little art myself. My ability to paint in the lines leaves much to be desired. But overall, the community vibe was great, even despite the dire conditions that teachers and the students and families they serve are facing. And naturally, I couldn't help but zoom back and wonder, when we continue to print money for the military and local elected officials are finding new ways to increase the police budget, how are we in this position where education as a whole is fighting over scraps? With that in mind, I spoke with Portland Association of Teachers to get some more insight. Check out my interviews with Angela Bonilla, PAT President, Joanne Shepherd, PAT-PAC Liaison, and Jackie Dixon, PAT Vice President, on this, again, special episode of the Bruce Poinsett Show. Recording this Saturday, 23rd. So first question, obviously, is like, what is the status? I know last time I've been following the news. Last time I checked, you're at an impasse. Mm-hmm. And there's supposed to be, I think, a meeting last night.
Well, we did not have a meeting. We don't have any more bargaining sessions with the district until October. Mm-hmm. So last night is when our final offers were due to the Employment Relation Board. So that's what it was. So we have, once we declare impasse, the district and the union have 7 days to give their final offer. And it's final in quotation marks because we keep bargaining and trying to get a settlement. So we put our district mandated proposal out, which is the one full of the topics that the district is forcing us to talk about. Not necessarily all the topics we know are most important to our students and our families. So we've also created a student-centered package that we've sent to the district as well, which is like not legally binding for them to have to look through it, but we wanted to give an alternative vision. The student-centered package really is some of the most important issues to our members, but the district mandated package is the only one that they have to legally legally talk to us about.
So I said, there's a bunch of details in there, but can you just give like a broad overview as far as like, what's the difference? Like, what are the talking points when you say that the district is focusing on? Because when I look at the news stories again, I see obviously compensation as well as class sizes, caseloads. How is that different from what is in the student center package that isn't getting covered that you think needs more attention?
Yeah. So in our district mandated proposal, the district only has to create class size as a mandatory bargaining topic for Title I schools. We think every kid deserves a reasonable class size. It doesn't matter if you go to a Title I school or not. And so our student-centered proposal speaks more to what it would look like if we have class size caps for everyone, while our district-mandated proposal is really focusing on you know, the class size caps for Title I schools, as well as increased planning time for educators who are not in Title I schools as workload relief for excessive classes. Because, you know, if you have 35 students, each student gets 1/35 of your attention, right? And then it's not even that much if some of those students have special education plans, or they're English language learners, or they're going through some stuff at home. So you got to provide more supports or connect them to services. So we know that it just takes more time. And we've asked for that in our district mandated proposal, but we would just prefer to have class size caps across the board. Another piece that we can't really place in our district mandated proposal is the mental health teams at every school. So right now, PPS has this system. Legally, they can choose between a school counselor and a school social worker. They're interchangeable under the law, but they do very different jobs. And we believe you need a counselor, a social worker, and a school psychologist assigned to every school. Because otherwise, when there's an incident, what happens is that the district sends people to the site to support, and then they fly back out. And then everyone's processed the shock of whatever just happened, and now they need the help, and there's no one there. Or there's only one mental health professional. So our proposal says that every school should have school counselors, school social workers, school psychologists, and a qualified mental health professional. And our mandatory, like, district mandated proposal says that they need to give us additional planning time for every one of those roles that doesn't exist in a school. Because we're not going to be as efficient as a classroom teacher looking for services for a student as a social worker would be. And then they would be able to do it for every kid that needs it in the building. And the district doesn't have to talk to us about that. So we can't put it in our final proposal legally. And so these are the kinds of pieces that we've really been struggling with, is that our staff are exhausted from large class sizes, high levels of need from even more students than before the pandemic, and we're not getting more support. And so if we don't get the people in the building to help the kids and do the service, then we need the time to do that right by the kids. It just is going to create a system that's haphazard and changes based on whether you have a teacher who's done this for 20 years and has connections in the city versus someone who just got out of grad school and is like doing their best and hopes they're helping you, but doesn't know where to send you. So those are two very big pieces. And then when it comes to caseload for special ed, especially, we just have special educators who have these large caseloads. And then we also have a lot of, because we have a lot of vacancies. And when we talk about these pieces, it's hard because they're all interconnected, right? Like, how do you get more educators to your district? You pay a wage that is attractive and allows you to live in the city you work, right? Right now, Portland is the second least affordable city if you're a first-year teacher renting a one-bedroom apartment. We're only behind San Francisco. It is less expensive to live in New York City and work in New York City as a teacher and rent a one bedroom than it is here in Portland. And that's wild, right? And so we need salary that actually helps us catch up and keep up with the rates of inflation and everyone else in our area, because other districts can do it. Why can't we? And one thing we saw from Baker City, because they had all that news about the superintendent giving everyone a like minimum salary of, I think it was like $80,000 or something. There was an article that NEA Today posted. They started this year with zero vacancies. So it's not a teacher shortage. It's a pay shortage. It's a respect shortage, right? And so once they show us that respect in the check, once they make sure they give us all the tools we need so that kids actually get served versus just warehoused, then you're going to have staff coming here. But people are struggling and they're looking at this job and saying, I don't think I can do this for 20 more years. And who gets hurt when that happens? That's our kids, right? It's our kids who have to live in the city and go to school for the next, you know, for 12, 13 years of their lives, who won't have that stability. And a lot of our kids have already experienced that because a lot of our schools have already been underserved and underfunded for years. So sorry, I just get on my side because I get so upset, because it's like, we're not asking for bonkers things. We're asking for a functional school district, and they're painting us like we're these like racist, awful teachers who hate brown kids and want to destroy everyone's lives by going on strike, when we just want a reasonable contract.
Well, it just seems like, you know, I think about the conditions right now, one society period, but just like, if there's anything to invest in, you know, to bump the investment in just morally as a society, it's education. But even my experience in PPS, I'm, you know, I do a little bit of guest teaching. My mom worked in PPS as an administrator for about 3 decades. But, you know, I just see, especially when you talk about post-pandemic, because the classroom environment is different. Even something, I feel like a lot of things when I talk with teachers or talk with like other guest teachers, the thing they notice first, just like, it's different with phones now. Mm-hmm. It's different, like just the things that, again, you get used to coming back in. Like, so in addition to having, you said 35 students in the classroom, it's the other, like the mental health stuff, the coping stuff is different. Having support staff is necessary.
Yes.
It feels like, I kind of talked about just like the strain, but just like talk a little bit more, just like as a teacher, just just how difficult it is in this new environment.
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing with a lot of our students, because, you know, the pandemic isn't over, and we had these closures that, you know, the Oregon Health Authority said, because of how long we stayed closed in this state, we were able to save over like 6,000 lives compared to other states where they opened things right up and people caught COVID and passed away, right? So we have shown as a state that when we need to come together and do right by each other, we can and we do, and it can make a difference, right? And we have kids showing up into our schools who lost people. Right. I one of the first times back from the closures, I was supporting a classroom, a third grade classroom, and this kid was refusing to go to recess. He was just very upset and like kind of closed off. And so the teacher was like, I need support. I need to take my kids to recess. Can you stay with him? And I did. And I was like, do you want to tell me what's going on? He just like shook his head. I was like, do you want to draw what's going on? And he started drawing. And I realized he's drawing a funeral. He's drawing a hole in the ground. He's drawing a cross. He's drawing people crying. And he was like, yeah, because my dad died. And then this other thing and this other thing and this other thing. And it's like, okay, if there wasn't an adult like me, what happens to that kid, right? The class can't go out to recess. So everyone's like, what's going on? Or we have to like call for an administrator to come and try to sit with the kid. Or it becomes a disciplinary issue because the kid's like, I'm not listening. I don't care if someone who's not trained to have those types of conversations with kids and be like, hey, why don't you draw this instead of saying it? Or do you want to tell someone else? Is there another adult? Like, if you don't have those people, it's hard to support students. And with all the other traumas that have come up, we're seeing that come into our schools, right? So there's the change in technology. Our kids were forced to find ways to connect with other humans through technology. So it's become more prevalent. Like, I remember I taught sixth grade for 1 year before the pandemic. And we had issues where we were like, the admin had to contact Instagram because someone's like posting beautiful floral pictures. Then you read the comments like, this girl's a piece of shit because da 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 da. And everyone's like, oh my God, like cyberbullying, we got to deal with this. But after the pandemic, it was like, that wasn't just one person with one account, right? It's everyone is living this virtual life because that was how you connected for 2 years, right? That's how you got to talk to your friends, see your family. And then, you know, I'm not the kind of teacher that takes stuff from kids because I'm like, that's basically an extension of your body. I'm not touching your body. Like, I'm going to give you options, right? But you end up with kids who are really feeling like that tech is a security blanket. It is something that makes me feel safe. And when we put that in the context of modern education, right? Like, we do active shooter drills every other month. Mm. If you're a teen, you might not be willing to give up that phone for that period or leave it at home or leave it in your locker when every month we have to train you to be worried that you might have to hide from someone shooting you in your school. On top of that, you end up with younger kids who have been, because people didn't have support and resources, right? Like in Oregon, we have a lot of multi-generational families, but also a lot of transplants. So you end up with people who don't have that village that they would have had to support them with their kids. And then during COVID, you're all isolated. So I need to take a shower and I have two kids. I'm putting the tablet out for you to watch that Bluey episode so that I can be clean, you know? And so like, it's not that people are bad for putting their kids on devices. It's that it's a necessary tool when you have no other options, but it was a necessary tool for almost everyone for almost 2 years. And so, you know, we end up with kids who are having a hard time with their attention spans because there's not that instant gratification. Productive struggle, which is something we do all the time in the classroom, isn't necessarily how all games work. Like, you've seen the kids on video games who are like, I'm going to grind at this for hours because I'm going to try. But like, how about when it's multiplication? Like, you might not have that same like gusto for that. So we're seeing that change socially, but we're not given the tools in our schools to meet that challenge and meet them where they are. And instead we're doing things like, well, they're doing tech, so let's give them more computer-based assessments. And then it's like, okay, but now you have a kindergartner who's used to using a touchscreen being put in front of a Chromebook 2 weeks after they started school, where they're like, I never went to preschool. I'm Black. There's a lot of white people here. Like, I don't know what I'm doing here. Like, I'm usually with my grandma. Like, this is crazy. I'm gonna put you in front of a computer and make you take a math test to know whether you know math. Like, we're not even getting good data from the things we're forcing them to do in a way, in despite the mindset of this is going to help us with, you know, they're meeting them where they are because they already had to use tech. And it's like, those things aren't the same. Like, we need to integrate technology in a way that supports students, but we also need to make sure we're not overusing technology as an excuse to then not serve student needs. Because you put the kindergartner in front of a computer for a test, they're just popping through it because they're like, oh, when's recess? This is boring. I mean, you do that for high schoolers. They're like, oh, when's lunch? This is boring. So, you know, we have to rise to meet the moment, and we don't have the resources to do that in our schools right now.
The Bruce Points That Show will be back right after these messages.
Saving energy is bigger than saving a buck. It's protecting places we love so we can pass them down to people we love. It's saving on bills so that you can save up for big moments while creating a brighter future for all of us. So wherever you live, start saving with Energy Trust of Oregon. You can save up to 60% on energy efficient products at energytrust.org/save.
Welcome back to the Bruce Poinsett Show.
So I want to be respectful of your time. I know we're kind of a little bit over already, but just lastly ask, because you mentioned earlier just being kind of like painted as, oh, we hate Black and brown students because we're going on strike. And when I think about that, I think about like events like today and a public art bill and the opportunity, one, just to engage with the teachers and also, you know, creating something in support of this work. But yeah, can you just talk a little bit more about just like the significance of like this kind of like specific type of activity?
Yeah. So as a Afro-Latina and a Black teacher in Spanish immersion school, schools here in Portland, even though I was teaching fourth grade, I was usually the first Black teacher my students had. And so every Black kid in the building would know who I was because they were like, ooh, you, like someone that looks like me. And I grew up in the Bronx, New York. So I grew up in an enclave where I was able to build my identity surrounded by people that looked like me versus building my identity, constantly comparing myself to a status quo, to a norm. And so when I see these kids, like, I can see that need to feel reflected and to feel a sense of belonging in our schools. And we know that not everyone is great at dealing with people who have cultures different than their own, right? And that's why it's so important for us to have these spaces where we can build something together, where we get to see each other and know each other, not as like, I'm your teacher and I'm telling you what to do in this classroom and you're that student who always is talking and not listening. It's like, no, we're just going to paint a banner together and talk about how cool this is, right? And I think too, for educators, like, we have language in our contract the district keeps bringing up about how we have these mandatory minimums. We want to expel our and suspend our Black and brown kids. And they don't paint the full story of the fact that that language is in there because educators were being harmed and the district wasn't taking it seriously and not giving kids the support they needed, right? Because if a kid hits me, That's not the first thing they did saying, I need more help. Mm-hmm. This place ain't working for me, right? But what pushes someone to that point? It's the lack of support, the lack of listening, the lack of anyone trying to get them the help and getting them the help for a long time. And so what we've asked the district to do is train every, we put in our contract that they have to train every educator on anti-racism, implicit bias, and culturally responsive practices. We put that in our contract in 2020. They didn't start doing that until this school year, right? And then they're saying, well, we're disproportionately disciplining Black and Brown boys. Well, the district also disproportionately disciplines Black and Brown educators and educators of color. So it's a system problem. And we need to solve it. And saying that these teachers are the reason that these kids aren't getting the support when the district is the institution that chooses the suspension and does the discipline poorly for all people of color, whether you're a child or an adult, it's really disingenuous to keep hearing that kind of inflammatory language when we know that they're not doing their part in helping us help our kids. Because I shouldn't be the only Black teacher kids have, and I shouldn't be the first Black teacher by the time that they're 9 and 10, right? But what is making it that we don't feel like we can be teachers here in this district? And so, you know, I think it's these are really big bummers to talk about, and that's why it's so important to have spaces where we can create joy and we can create, help create the vision for what is possible. Like I was saying about COVID, COVID helped us learn that we can do more for each other than we've been led to believe, that we can care for each other more deeply than we were led to believe. And if we can come together and say, no, our schools need to be at this level, period. Not if you have enough money, not if this year works out, not if the state wants to fund it. That is it. There is no other option because our kids deserve that. So being able to come together and like envision that through a huge parachute that says like our schools power our communities and this is what solidarity looks like it gives me chills because it reminds us that like what we do is in support and in service of our community, and we're not trying to like get over on anyone. We're just trying to strengthen our communities by strengthening our schools, and an art build like this helps us put that into images, not just words. So that's because, as you can tell, I'm very verbose. So that's what is so important and awesome about having an art build.
Yeah, yeah. Again, thank you for taking the time. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, I mean, I just hope that we can get to a settlement that actually serves all of our kids and all of our families and creates a Portland Public Schools that people feel like they want to send their kids to and want to work at. And I hope that the district takes our student-centered proposal as an option. They don't have to legally, but we hope that they'll look at it and see that really it's, if we're all on the same page about what our kids deserve and what we need to move towards, then let's do it. Let's take that leap of faith. Let's push back this crisis of imagination and imagine that we can have this better school district, this better world. And let's do it. Like, let's find ways to help people find housing in our district, right? So that they don't have to move out to the numbers because they can't afford to live in their historical neighborhood where their houses were demolished, right? Like, how do we repair the harm that this predominantly white, historically Black exclusionary state has done? Because schools should be transformative. They should help kids see what's possible. And if we can do that through this contract, we're going to change this world, not just this city, not just this district, not just the state. So I just want folks to know that, you know, I'm optimistic. I'm going to be an elementary teacher all the time. So I'm always going to believe that we can do hard things and we can make things happen as long as we take care of each other and support each other and fight together. So, yeah.
Can you just talk a little bit about like what it looks like on the ground in the classroom?
Yeah. So last year, you know, I had a class of about 24 students and they had a lot of needs. Like I had kids that needed really one-on-one support and there wasn't anybody to fill those positions. So we even had like it was open, it was posted, right? Like it was like to be an assistant for a student in my classroom, and nobody applied for the job. Like, I think that is the prime example for me of like what it's like right now, where things are so crappy that people don't want to work in schools in Portland. The pay is low if you're an assistant. The hours are rough. Like, you don't, often you don't get breaks, or you are forced to work during a break. And, you know, it can be not very rewarding because it's so demanding. And often if you're a person who's an assistant working one-on-one with a student, you don't get the same kind of, you know, fun playtime with all the other kids, because you're working like one-on-one with a student who needs a lot of intensive needs. So it's just not the same kind of environment.
And yeah, Angela and I were kind of talking about how just like how this isn't specifically how the teachers are kind of like painted in these negotiations in media as saying like, oh, you basically, the idea is like, you don't care about Black and brown kids because you're going on strike. But I don't know, like, I feel like that's just like an added layer when you're, again, in the classroom dealing with all the things. But to that end, though, can you just talk about the importance of events like this, both in terms of just community engagement with teachers and also like actually creating art in support of the work?
Yeah. So a couple of things comes to mind, right? Is like the idea that if we go on strike, we're somehow harming Black and brown kids, which is not true at all. If we don't fight for what we know is right for our kids, including our Black and brown kids, then nothing will change. So either we don't go on strike, we agree to management's terms, and everything stays the same, or we fight for something more, right? And that's where we're at. We're saying we want more for our kids, and especially for our Black and brown kids. We know they deserve better. I mean, we're looking at, you know, what's happening in Jefferson High School, right? Where a historically Black community is once again being forced to be bused to the outskirts of town when they could have, this whole process could have been done differently. So that's what we're fighting for. We're fighting for real community engagement and real like community advocacy and ownership in all of these different decision-making circles and tables that are happening. So this event, this art build, what we're doing is bringing people to our hall, to our union hall, to show them like what we're about, right? Which is like about joyful advocacy. Like we are like making art, we're talking to each other, we're eating together, like we're having real time. Like there's no, it's not a formal sit down at this table and everyone take turns saying what you think our schools need. Like we're actually working together and doing things in a way that is organic and not forced.
And is there, like, if the strike goes through, it'd be the first one in like Portland public schools history.
Yeah.
But is there any significance to this also happening in the midst of like larger, I want to say like the biggest strike wave in the U.S. in like a few decades, or even I was just looking at the stories earlier where, you know, you just had recent short-lived, but strikes in, I'll say Camas and Evergreen.
Yeah.
But yeah, is there, yeah, again, to say like significance as far as, or does it help that it's in kind of the midst of this atmosphere?
I think it definitely helps. This whole fight was supposed to be in 2020, right? So like our whole union was gearing up for this huge contract fight. This exact same fight we were going to do before the pandemic. And then the pandemic shut everything down, right? So I think it's also interesting to think about that context of like our teachers, our educators have been waiting for this for now almost 4 years, you know? So like there's even more of that added pressure and buildup, right? Because like we were getting ready to do this back in 2019, 2020. So that, and then you add to it this national narrative where we're seeing successful labor actions across the country, both in schools and not in schools, right? Like the auto workers are on strike right now. We saw it with UPS workers who didn't go on strike, but they almost did, you know? So the wave of strikes and labor actions, I think, is all just adding fuel to the fire that this community specifically, like, already ignited 4 years ago. So.
And you mentioned before we hit record that's your ninth year in education, mm-hmm. correct? This is your first year out of the classroom. Do you feel like it was was this something you were, well, it sounds like it wasn't something you were, just a position you were planning to be in, but.
No, I would love to talk about that. So, so this is my ninth year in education and my first year not in a classroom. When I was a first grade teacher, I fought so hard to get all my students things that they needed, right? Like, I got rain boots for all my students. I got, you know, field trips. I fundraised. I did all of these things for them. And I had a few students who had really intense, severe medical needs, and they just needed more support than I could give them. And I worked through the, you know, appropriate channels, right, to, you know, say this child needs these supports, and was just met with so much pushback and being told no over and over and over again. And I had this parent crying on the phone to me, you know, like, what else can we do? What do we do? Like, we all know that her child needs these supports. And we in the end, we did get her what she needed. But it was how much of a fight it took from me and this parent working together that it really broke me down a little bit with, like, the way that this system prevents people from getting what they need, right? And it just took so much work. And all of that work obviously took away from my time to plan for the other 20-something kids in that class, right? So it's just like, it really broke me down in a lot of ways. And that was a few years ago. And since then, I had just decided, like, I'm going to do what these families need. And, like, the other stuff is just going to have to be pushed to the side. So I started doing community events. Like, I worked with my school leadership team, and we hosted a vaccine clinic during the pandemic. I worked with a community here called the Community Cycling Center, and got recycled bikes for like 50 kids in our school over the course of a couple of years. And those things, those like community focused events, reaching out to families, doing home visits, talking to families, that just became my source of joy in my work. And it was less about whether or not a kid, you know, passed this test as a 6-year-old. Like, I just stopped caring about all of that stuff. And so when this opportunity opened up, when this job became available, it felt like a really natural fit for me to still be in the education world, but doing what I love the most, which is connecting with families, organizing, you know, teaching them how to advocate for themselves, how to talk back to PPS management, you know, those kinds of things. So, I got the job in July, and I've been emailing, calling, texting, visiting, having coffee with families like every day, multiple families a day. And it's really rewarding. It feels really good.
Thank you again for taking the time. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think specifically what I've known and have really seen in these past 2 months is that our Black and Brown families don't feel heard or respected by either PPS management or the teachers union. And something that I'm really proud of is this union's leadership and our staff's commitment to prioritizing our Black and Brown families and repairing the harm that we know has gone on since, you know, the dawn of Portland being a racist place, right? Like, so I just, like, I want to say that I recognize that the teachers union has not been an ally for our Black and Brown families, and we are changing that. We're actively working on that. So it feels like good work to know that we're doing that. Like, specifically around, like, the Jefferson move right now, we're really prioritizing the families in the Jefferson community.
Offline, we were talking about just the surprise, kind of like the turnout last night. But can you just talk about both, like, the energy and the turnout so far, about, you know, a day and a half into this?
Yeah. So it's really beautiful how the community is showing up. We've had a lot of students a lot of community members just showing up in solidarity, helping us paint banners. I think we got through like 10 banners today, which we're ahead of schedule. It's lovely. And it's just, it's reassuring, I think, to have folks show up in such large numbers. Because, you know, striking, or the fear of striking, I guess, is out there. And we know that students being in schools is really important, and we want to make sure that our families are with us. So this helps us know that our families got our backs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, just going around talking with teachers, different other staff members represented out here, you know, there's been a lot of talk about kind of like the narrative that kind of comes across in the media, mm-hmm. and this idea of like, oh, the teachers, they must hate Black and brown children because they want to go on strike. But then there's like the realities of the conditions you're being expected to teach in. And even just to think about just the buildings themselves, like you've been, remind me, how long have you been in PPS now?
Almost 20 years. So since 2005.
Right. Yeah. And can you just talk about just like how much it feels like so many of these buildings are so, I don't know, just how much is really like not changed when it comes to like the conditions.
Right. So I think, you know, PPS is slowly remodeling high schools one by one. And that's really just not meeting the standards of what we need, what our students and the children deserve. Yeah. So things like rodents, rats, mice in buildings, like the idea of something of the buildings being moderately dingy as a classification for how dirty they are regularly is pretty wild to me. So, you know, we have very old buildings, some of them literally older than 100 years. Jefferson comes to mind. Mm-hmm. And rodent problems, right? Where in the places of learning, or at Ockley Green, they've had rodents, for example. Places of learning, like in a gym where children would be laying down, you know, doing different physical activities, to know that there's rats running through there at times is pretty disgusting. Our students definitely deserve better than that. Also, just the extreme temperature changes, I think, is something that really concerns me. And it's inhumane. It's really like a human rights issue when our buildings cannot stay between 60 and 90 degrees on any given hot day. So if it's like 80 degrees outside, we have a lot of buildings that on the second or third levels would then be like over 90 degrees, mm-hmm. you know, upper 90 degrees. There was, I think it was Ida B. Wells that I was visiting at the beginning of this school year, or the last, or the end of last school year. I can't remember. It was a really hot day, and they were clocking literally 100 degrees in some rooms. So those are not acceptable learning conditions. Mm-hmm. Our students can't be expected to learn in those conditions, and their learning conditions are our working conditions.
Yeah. So it was at Ida B. Wells for literary arts, like guest teaching. Mm-hmm. And this is in the fall, so it's not, the weather is not that bad outside. Mm-hmm. But like in the mornings, just the way it was, it's like you expect to like walk into a sauna in the classroom. It's just like, this can't be, this can't be conducive to, you know, any kind of effective learning.
Right. And knowing kind of the socioeconomics even of certain school communities, mm-hmm. and who is able to, who has the resources and the skill sets to advocate for our students, right? Right. And the time, and knowing that Ida B. Wells is like a relatively higher socioeconomic mm-hmm. area than others, and that they're still facing those things, or like Cleveland as well, right? It gets really, really hot on the second and third floors. It's pretty wild.
Yeah. But then like I said, like go look at Jeff, it's like an over 100-year-old building. And yeah. I did a visioning session where, you know, students were just talking about just like lead in the water and all this, just
mm-hmm. asbestos bubbles mm-hmm. In random buildings. I think it was Laurelhurst that literally has like an asbestos bubble that's just been there for years. Ida B. Wells, like we were talking about with the heat, they have a group of educators who really advocated very strongly for better working conditions there, better learning, conditions for students. And so they were able to get, I think, a dozen or so air conditioners, like window air conditioners, installed recently. But that was only after educators really pushed hard, I mean, filed grievances, did everything very methodically for over a year, complaining about the heat, you know, and it's not a new problem. So,
yeah. So, speaking of not a new problem, so this would be, if the strike does end up happening, it would be the first one in PPS history. I know, I want to say they were on the verge of one in 2014.
Yeah.
Yeah. But one, just obviously being in the system in both of these times, like, is there, do you feel like there's something different now than there was then? And also, does it help at all that we're kind of in the midst of a larger strike wave across the country? And yeah, does that, I guess, help boost morale in any way?
Yeah, I think when we look at the labor movement and where we're at, like in the labor movement, and you have everyone from, you know, Amazon to Starbucks to Burgerville to New Seasons workers striking, I do feel like the idea of striking to get the things that we really need for our students becomes more normalized. Right. There's always the fear, I think, of what's going to happen to children if they're out of school. But realistically, what's going to happen to children if the conditions don't change? So I do feel like it provides some reassurance, seeing that parents are coming out and supporting, seeing that other strikes in neighboring districts have been successful recently, like Evergreen, mm-hmm. Silver Falls, Camas. There's another one, Woodburn. We don't want to strike. And at the same time, I think the cost of living increases, and where we're at economically in Portland is somewhat new phase, right? Like, I'm a longtime Portlander, grew up here, and it used to be like livable, right? And I think that's what used to attract families to Portland, is that, you know, you could move here and afford to really raise a family. And you know, speaking from personal experience as a teen parent, I was able to afford a one bedroom apartment at 16, working like, you know, minimum wage jobs and going to school. Now I don't think folks in their 20s can really do that themselves in Portland. So our new educators are put in a position where it's like, oh, you get to choose, am I going to pay my rent or am I going to buy my groceries? And they've got student loans, you know, they've gone to school for 5 years, they're trying to like really build a sustainable career. So I think something that's different is just like the economics in Portland and inflation, and we haven't caught up. We're trying to play catch up. Our previous contracts did not land with a cost of living that kept up with inflation. So we're already like behind, if you think about it that way, economically, when we've landed, you know, 4% previously for multiple contracts, or around 4%. And then we know inflation was something like 8% in the same year. It's like a game of catch up. So. Trying to catch up.
Yeah, well, Jackie, thank you for the time. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think the only thing I would like to add is that there is a lot of misinformation out there. And when folks have questions, our community has questions, I hope that they are also checking like the Portland Teachers website and getting information directly from the source. I've seen some media stories that are pretty disturbing and misleading as far as like what we're asking for. And it's too bad when it turns into like this game of whose narrative gets out there first. So everything we're asking for is reasonable. Everything we're asking for is doable. And the district does have the funds. We'll be releasing more information with like a financial research paper coming up next week, I believe, and taking a deep dive into how is Portland Public Schools spending, how have they been spending their funds, how much money is being spent on top heavy administration and central office, how much money is being spent on outside contracts versus spending that money and investing in students like our families deserve.
This has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Again, you can catch us every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7, or you can catch clips on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. If you want access to exclusive bonus coverage, you can go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. And make sure to follow us on Twitch at twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM, that's numbers with a Z, or on the Numbers Podcast Network on all podcasting platforms, or thenumberspodcast.com. Again, that's numbers with a C.
Support for The Numbers comes from HealthShare Oregon. A well-child doctor appointment is a safe and easy way to stay up to date on routine screenings. You can also get protected from diseases like measles and even some cancers. More at HealthShareOregon.org/wellness.